Hello and welcome to the weekly podcast from the Mattoon Public Library. I'm Carl Walworth, the library director. The podcast is a way each week for us to work on our library's vision of sparking ideas, enriching lives, and strengthening community. And this week, we're going to talk about the upcoming solar eclipse on August the 21st that is going to be most prevalent in southern Illinois, down in the Chester-Carbondale area, but which will be, hopefully, if we have a nice clear day, we'll have a good look at it right here in the Coles County region. And here with me today are Don Packey and Dave Linton from the Physics Department at Eastern Illinois University. We're glad to have them and look forward to their insights. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
Gentlemen, let's start and talk just a little about what an eclipse is and why this is such a big deal.
Well, an eclipse is a blocking of light. I think it comes from the Greek word eclipsis, means to eat. I think that's true. And a lot of cultures have thought of the sun being eaten during this event, the solar eclipse. Of course, the moon's light can be blocked during a lunar eclipse, and that would happen when the moon is full and then goes into the shadow of the earth. The sun's light can be blocked if the moon is in between us and the sun. And that's what's going to happen this year on August 21st.
And so y'all don't always get in the limelight each day in the news, but this has been. I was in Carbondale a year ago, and they were already making preparations. I know the hotels are booked. There's a lot of excitement around this on all levels. That must be fun for folks in your profession to have an event like this that is front and center in people's minds.
It is. It's really given me something to focus on in this last year. But I've been aware, maybe before a lot of people in Carbondale, that the eclipses were going to cross in this century. The eclipse of 2017 and the eclipse of 2024, the path of totality intersects right there very close to Carbondale. And so they get two of them in a short period of time. But they've gone for a long time without eclipses.
This is Don. I also wanted to point out that this gives us a really good opportunity for people to help people to visualize their place in the solar system. I mean, you know, a lot of astronomy is very far away and hard to imagine. Like my degree was, my thesis was about neutron stars, which is about as far away and exotic as you can get. But, you know, we look up in the sky, we see the stars, the sun, the moon. And for that purpose, I think we should remember that everything in the solar system basically moves towards the east. You know, we see the sun rising in the east because the Earth is rotating towards the east. Well, the moon, as it goes around the Earth, is also moving to the east, from west to east. And the Earth, as it goes around the sun once a year, is also moving west to east. So that brings us to the question, why does the eclipse move across the surface of the Earth in the direction that it does and take as long as it does? And that's a little bit complicated, but I think if people spend the time to try to visualize it, it'll really help them to see what's going on. So yeah, the Earth rotates west to east once every day. Moon goes around the Earth once every month. Earth goes around the sun once a year. So during the course of this eclipse, basically the Earth isn't moving really at all. And so I think one really good way to think about this is if the moon were actually completely standing still in the sky, which it can't do, then we know that as the Earth rotated, the eclipse would have to move from east to west, just as we see the sun moving from east to west. And it would take 4 hours to go the four time zones of the United States. But in fact, what's going to happen is it's going to hit in the northwest up in Oregon and move across the south towards the southeast, exiting in South Carolina 90 minutes later. And so what that means is that the important thing that's going on here is that the moon is moving from west to east, and its shadow is therefore moving west to east faster than the Earth is rotating under it.
That's very cool. And I, from what I've read, the path of the totality is 60 to 70 miles wide or something of that nature. What can we expect I mean, if we have a good clear day, how much of that do you think we'll see, or can we hopefully see here in the Coles County region?
Well, you won't see the sun totally eclipsed from Coles County, but the 68-mile diameter shadow path means anyone inside of that path has a chance to see the sun completely blocked out. As the shadow races towards you from the west, if you happen to be standing on the center line somewhere along that path from Oregon, Salem, Oregon, to Charleston, South Carolina, the shadow was coming in at a significant speed. You see the sky darken. If the sky is clear to begin with, nice blue sky, let's hope that's what we start with. It begins to darken. It turns to purple and black. And it's getting darker faster than you realize it because your pupil, the pupil of your eye, is opening wider to compensate for this lessening amount of light. And then the pupil reaches its maximum size, can't get any bigger, and it seems like it goes much faster towards the end. But also what's happening is that you begin to see off in the distance towards the west a kind of a salmon color along the horizon. It's almost really very similar to a sunset color, but I think not exactly, because the light you're seeing beyond the edge of the shadow where the sun's light is past the far edge of the moon, falling down towards the ground and being scattered off of atmospheric molecules over there, and there's a lot of blue light that's removed. It's the same effect that gives us a blue sky in the first place, but this light coming laterally along the horizon for, let's say, 34 miles if it's a 68-mile diameter shadow, really has the colors look quite different. And so you look at your neighbor who's looking at this happen also, and that neighbor looks a little odd because they're illuminated by a strange combination of colors, as well as looking rather dark, darkened by the lack of light.
Right. Would it be worth? I know there are some people. I know some people are going to Southern Illinois to see it, and as opposed to looking here. And I know the two of you are. Is that worth? I guess other people have to gauge if it's worth the trip or not. But they will just see the totality than we will here. Is that how that works?
Well, they will see a different kind of eclipse if they are across the line, mm-hmm. where is the northern edge of the shadow. Mm-hmm. The umbra, the central dark shadow of the moon. Outside of that point, if you're a little bit north, you see a northern part of the sun above much of the sun, which is blocked by the moon. So you would see a crescent in the sky, I suppose. And that's called a partial eclipse versus a total solar eclipse. And a total solar eclipse, I've had my lawyer has asked me, or said something to the effect of, it's 95% eclipsed here in Champaign. Why would I ever drive 3 hours south to see just a measly five more percent? And I had to talk to him about that.
What is the answer to that?
The answer to that, I think, is embodied in many people's descriptions of eclipses. Including the woman who went to Antarctica to see a 70-year-old woman, widowed lady from Botswana, who was actually a U.S. citizen, went to Antarctica to see an eclipse. How did she fund it? She sold her house. When she was done, she told the tour director, "I got my money's worth. It was well worth it." And another quote that I would share with you is, I forget who to attribute this to, but... when you rate natural wonders on a scale of 1 to 10, a total solar eclipse rates a million.
Right. Yeah. Good. Now, the first thing you shared with me tonight was some safety information, and perhaps that would be good for our listeners to know. Do you really need to have glasses? And if you don't have glasses, I know I saw a video you had the other day where there are some other ways where you can use maybe nature and some other things to experience have a very cool experience.
Yes, there are other ways. There's direct ways and indirect ways of watching this eclipse. Direct ways would include looking towards the sun, but if you're going to do that, you have to have protection for your eyes. The eclipse glasses that Eastern has distributed, some of those, and they're distributed by others around the area and on the internet as well, those would protect your eyes from direct sunlight. Welder's glass, number 14 welder's glass, is also, in fact, I think is a better filter than the eclipse glasses. It protects better in the infrared and the ultraviolet. Indirect methods take the filter out of it, allow you to look downward. You can take a paper plate, poke a hole in it, tiny hole, have another one on the ground that doesn't have a hole in it, and cast a shadow from the plate you're holding onto the plate that's on the ground. And if you are turning the face of that plate towards the sunlight comes through that tiny hole and will make an image on that plate on the ground. Maybe 3 feet separation between the two at a maximum. You get an image of the sun. Well, if the sun is round, as it is today, appears round, you would get a round image. But if the sun is partially eclipsed, you could get a crescent shape. And you can watch that. It's safe to look at the light that falls on that on the ground. You can, this is called a pinhole projector. You can make a pinhole projector in a whole lot of ways. My favorite way is a Ritz cracker. Okay, the holes in a Ritz cracker actually can make tiny little crescents down there on the ground, but take extras. You're going to use them for other reasons. You can take a colander. You can take a pegboard. Hold that up above the ground, and those holes will project images, multiple images of the partially eclipsed sun. This is not during totality, but it's leading up to totality. It's prior to totality, before that central shadow gets to you. The sun is partially eclipsed. And how are you going to spend that 80, 85 minutes, I think? I was asked by a teacher today, do we just put the eclipse glasses on them and they keep them on there for that full 80 minutes? And I said, no. Put the glasses on them, or have them put them on the proper way. Teach them how to put them on. Have them look at the ground or straight ahead as they put them on. And once they get them on, then look at the sun. Don't do it in the opposite order. And then after they've looked, they see there's a little bite taken out of the sun. Take those glasses and put them in a box or something. Come back to them in 15 minutes. In the meantime, there's other things to do. Go over to a tree, a leafy tree. The leaves overlapping all the way up to the top of the tree make nature's pinholes. And on the ground underneath, on a sheet or on the sidewalk or on a sheet of paper, you've got hundreds or maybe thousands of images of the partially eclipsed sun. There are many other ways of making a pinhole projector. There are other ways of viewing the sun as well. You can take a flat mirror, tape all but a quarter inch square, doesn't even have to be square, it could be any shape, reflect the image through a window to the inside of a building. People who don't want to come outside or for whatever reason are inside, they can see an image. And that must be about 90 feet away with the size of the opening that I've described. But it's another way of looking at it. If you have a telescope or binoculars, you can project an image through the lens onto a sheet of paper or through the mirror, from the mirror of the telescope, through the eyepiece onto a sheet.
So there are multiple, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, well, I would just like to emphasize a few things that Dave said there. One is the huge difference between a partial eclipse and a total eclipse in terms of how you observe it. You know, so if you go down to southern Illinois and, the totality is approaching, well, at that point it's still partial. And so we can use all these methods. We can look through the eclipse glasses. You can project it through a pinhole or any of these methods. But before it's total, you cannot look at it even for a moment. I mean, the sun, how bright is the sun? Darn bright. And so when it's 95% covered up, it's still darn bright. And in fact, a nice image I got by reading something today was that, if you just sort of look at the sun unprotected, you'll have a round burned region in the back of your eye. Well, if you do that during an eclipse, you have a crescent-shaped burn on the back, on the retina of your eye. And, you know, that's not good. So, you know, I mean, it could be kind of, confusing when one hears it's 95% covered. They think, oh, certainly that must be good enough. But no, unless it's total,
yes,
you cannot look at with the naked eye. However, once it's total, you can look at it with the naked eye or through binoculars is a good way to observe, or a telescope. Now, totality lasts a maximum of 2 minutes and 40 seconds. And if you're at the edge of it, it'll be less than that, right? So you have to be careful, right? But you can observe it in those ways. And during totality, if you're actually observing the sun with your naked eye or binoculars or something, you'll be able to hopefully see the corona. I should defer to Dave, the voice of experience on this, because I have not actually seen a total solar eclipse. But that's the corona, the hot gases around the sun, are something that you'll never see during a partial eclipse.
They're up there all the time. The corona is there. It's sending its light to us, but we can't see it because the photosphere, which is the visible surface of the sun that we typically call the sun, that just overwhelms it. Once you get just above the photosphere, the brightness drops by a factor of a million. And then out just a little ways further, it's dropped by another factor of 1,000. It is very safe to look at, and yes, it can be quite beautiful.
Another thing I wanted to emphasize, I just happened to catch NPR's All Things Considered last night. They had a little four-minute sequence on eclipse safety, and they were emphasizing that you have to be very careful where you get the eclipse glasses. There are actually counterfeit ones out there. I mean, there's you know, different things. There's things that are sold as eclipse glasses but really aren't. And then there are ones that are just plain old counterfeits. They might even put the proper writing on them to indicate that they're certified, but they in fact aren't. So the AAS, the American Astronomical Society, has on their website, and that is actually, if you're interested, it would be go to eclipse.aas.org. You can click around a little bit, find their eye safety part. What they have is a list of legitimate sellers, vendors for glasses. The ones that we gave you are safe, I guarantee it, but you have to be actually careful. And then, you know, David mentioned also welder's glasses. One very specific thing they said there, you said shade 14. Well, what they said was shade 12, 13, or 14. But you can't just say welder's glasses. You have to actually, there are different shades of welder's glasses. So you really do have to be careful. If you've got something that's not proper, you might not notice it while you're observing. And in fact, you may not notice till the next morning when you wake up and you can't really see. Should that happen, they say that in about maybe 50% of the cases, depending on how bad the damage was, the damage will be repaired with time. In 50%, it's permanent. So it's nothing to mess around with, and you really do have to be careful.
So people need to be safe and enjoy the eclipse and enjoy this experience. And speaking of enjoying the experience, I've read a couple of pieces that strongly suggest don't take pictures of the eclipse, but do maybe take pictures or at least capture in words or however people might want to capture the experience of that they have and for those around them. Can you talk about that a little bit? And the best way to maybe make this an experience of a lifetime?
Recording what people felt during the eclipse, what they saw and what they felt, if that can be something for a family remembrance. You take your family to see the eclipse. Everybody's excited. There's a lot of anticipation. You glance at the sun through the eclipse glasses every few minutes, and you see that it's progressing, the moon's progressing along, and you see images on the ground in various ways. And then it finally happens, and it can be overwhelming. It has brought people to tears. It has given people what they thought was a greater connection with their God. It has given people a sense of oneness with the universe. They're aligned with the moon and the sun, and they start thinking maybe subconsciously about the tremendous distances that are involved, and it just becomes overwhelming. A colleague of ours from ISU, Carl Wenning, never saw a total eclipse, but he finally decided he was going to pay to go see one. Went to Bolivia, and high in the mountains there, the eclipse happened, and what he remembers most about it is something he wishes he had recorded, had an audio recording of. It was of another person there who kept saying, "Oh my God," over and over and over for several minutes of totality. You never know what you're going to say or anybody else. So what I like to do is to set up a video camera that's aimed at the individuals that I know are there. They're watching it together. And it's not aimed up at the sky so much, not aimed at the sun maybe at all, but a video camera that's purpose includes an audio recording of what people say. And the oohs, the ahs, the applause, it is just really quite astonishing.
And some people describe that experience as being gobsmacked.
They do? Where did you come up with that word?
Well,
you must be a librarian.
You use that word.
Yes. Yes. Overwhelmed.
And so that's what gobsmack means, is overwhelmed.
I think so.
Oh, I remember what I was about to say there, which is that, you know, we are in the age of selfies and posting photographs everywhere, and it would be real easy for people to get overly concerned with that. And, you know, I'm really glad that Dave, turned me on to that idea. I've never seen a total solar eclipse, that one should not be too much focused on a particular aspect, such as taking photographs of it. Otherwise, you're going to miss a large part of the experience. So, yeah, you know, use your eyes, your ears. Mm-hmm. And I think you say you can even feel a temperature drop sometimes.
Oh, yes. Yes, definitely. I would say at least 10 degrees Fahrenheit. It will depend upon the humidity and other factors, wind speeds. But the average drop, I think, is between 10 and 15 degrees.
So I know we understand the world through science. Is there a way that we can use this eclipse beyond the 2 minutes and however many seconds, and we can use this experience as we go forward in the world that you all work in every day?
Yes. I mean, historically, one example was in 1919, where Sir Arthur Eddington observed a solar eclipse and thereby proved Einstein's theory of general relativity. And to do the two-sentence version of that explanation, he predicted that that light is bent by strong gravity, such as produced by the sun. So the way that it worked was they observed the positions of stars that were very close to the sun. Now, why do you need an eclipse for that? Well, because you can't see stars in the daytime because the sun is so bright. But they did that observation, proved general relativity to be correct, and made Einstein an overnight star, right? But also, I know that in this particular case, something that's being done is there's a project called Citizen CATE, C-A-T-E, which I don't remember what it stands for, which has a lot of mainly amateur astronomers along the entire eclipse path taking photographs during totality. They're going to basically stitch them together into a movie so that you'll be able to see the motions of the, you know, the streams of plasma in the solar corona and, you know, study that.
Yes, in a more general sense, the power of science is really in the power of prediction. You make a prediction, turns out to be accurate, you understand the world, it shows that you understand the world pretty well. If you make a prediction and it's wrong, and this will be very, we'll know in southern Illinois, if the shadow doesn't show up, we don't understand the universe quite as well as we thought we did. But I don't think there's anywhere in science where it's so obvious and it has such an overwhelming effect in showing the precision with which the science has managed to be able to predict eclipses down to the second, down to the mile or fraction of a mile in location. It has not always been so, but in the 20th century, we got a lot better at it. It's not a simple thing to do. To actually predict it requires solving a polynomial that's got almost 38,000 numbers in it.
Wow.
Something I did not know until recently. But lots of things affect it. The moon is moving away from the Earth very slowly. That takes it, at causes it to go at a slower speed. The Earth is slowing in its rotation. If the polar caps were to melt somewhat, that means the ocean level would be higher. That would mean water would be sticking out at the equator a bit more. It's like the arms of the skater who was stuck out in doing a spin. It's going to rotate more slowly. All of these things are going on in some fashion on the Earth. And I think at the time, let me just say that For example, astrology also makes predictions. But what they don't do is to test, to see where they're wrong, and to go back and try to fix things a little bit, look more deeply at the phenomenon and try to come up with a better explanation that works better. Science is not just, the power of science is not just in making predictions. It's also, I think even more so, in the process of testing. And at a time when we have high belief in the U.S. in astrology, there is seemingly, I feel like, maybe an attack on science from one part of the political spectrum in terms of some sort of conspiracy to make up this concept of global warming. I think we need to be reminded that science is the method that civilization has come up with over thousands of years, with hundreds of thousands of contributors, to decide whether an idea is correct or false, more or more correct than a second idea. Good. We rely on that.
Let's take two more topics. One, I want to ask Dave, I know you said you started your career and you're ending your career with a solar eclipse, so maybe talk about that, the significance of that to you, and I think maybe you want to talk a little bit about the history of eclipse that from your standpoint, and then we're going to wrap up with Don talking about an event where maybe some people might want to attend over at Eastern to as a way to maybe enjoy the eclipse. So why don't you kind of talk about kind of the bookends of your career?
When I was in graduate school, was a long time ago, in 1970, I was in grad school in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I heard that Dr. Peterson down the hall had just landed a NASA grant. He had some money. And what was he going to do? He was going to go see an eclipse, and he was researching interplanetary dust. And as interplanetary dust may be formed by comets going around the sun or asteroids occasionally colliding, as that dust gets closer to the sun, it gets heated up and it vaporizes. So what he needed to do was to see that radiation coming from that dust as it vaporizes, but it's so close to the sun that the sun just overwhelms it, the photosphere, visible surface of the sun. So he would travel to eclipses around the globe. He had just come back from one in Russia, the Soviet Union at the time, and he would scan his equipment back and forth looking for this thermal radiation, infrared radiation. And so he had to cool the detector down to quite a low temperature with liquid nitrogen. And in the middle of, or at the corner, actually, of a watermelon patch in southern Mexico, almost to Guatemala, after a couple of thousand miles in a pickup truck, we watched the sun go out behind the moon, disappear, and our equipment was scanned back and forth across from one side of the sun to the other. Unfortunately, I have recollections of that center on flicking switches. I do not have recollections quite so much of the sky growing darker. And so when in 1979, my colleague, Daryl Seeley at Parkland, came to me and said, I want to go see that eclipse early next year. It was late 78 when he spoke to me. The eclipse was in February 79. I said, wait a minute, that's to the north, and it's February. That's far to the north. He said, yes, but he wanted to go. And I said, there are eclipses most years. You just have to wait for one to come. He says, do you know it's going to be 38 years before the next one comes? It's not going to be this century. It's going to be next century. I don't even know if I'm going to be alive then. I don't know how much money I'll have to travel to some foreign land to see an eclipse. That kind of convinced me that I should try, but I thought the administration would nix it. But they didn't. They encouraged it. And they said, yes, you can take students with you. The Astronomy Club, we're both advisors to the Astronomy Club. We filled a van with students. The college provided the van. We just had to buy the gas, as I recall. We also supplied the insulation in the inner walls of that van because it was not being normally driven to North Dakota. We went through an ice storm and a blizzard to get to North Dakota. We arrived in Fargo. It was 20 degrees below zero after having driven all night, wondering, are we sane? We're really doing this? And after getting advice from the Weather Bureau, we went to northwestern North Dakota, north of Minot, which is almost at the Canadian border, and we set up in the driveway of a weather observer, an amateur weather observer, so we had access to thermometer and the ability to read the barometric pressure, see if there was any change there. And we set up early enough that we got to stand out in the middle of the road and watch the shadow come. And here's the shadow racing in, as I remember, it was about 2,000 miles per hour. And the sky gets darker and darker and darker, and then this pink salmon color appears along the western horizon and starts to spread out further and further away from, it's wider, okay, over much more of the horizon. And finally, it's really dark. It's dark. There's a purple and black. It's not a cloud, but the sky is that color. There's not a cloud up there. And the oldest member of our group was not me. I was in very early 30s at the time, and we had a 50-odd-year-old person who was very expert in using a telescope and a camera. He and the two of us and students who were probably 18 to 20 years old were in the middle of the road jumping up and down like children who had just arrived at Disney World for the first time. It was literally jumping for joy. It was emotional in the extreme. And yet we hadn't been looking at the sun. We'd just been looking at the environment. And it got so dark that it suddenly realized, oh my goodness, maybe it's total now. We looked up and it was. And we had to run to our telescopes and our cameras to start getting pictures, because we had been so distracted by the events surrounding this. And that's without any animals around. I don't think there was a bird to be seen in that part of North Dakota. Animals, including insects, will respond with nighttime behavior during the lead up to totality and then again during totality.
So an experience that you'll never forget, and you started your career with near the beginning of solar eclipse, and now you get to wrap it up.
Yes.
Or come to the end with another one.
Well, there's medical reasons. My back's been hurting a bit more than it did at a younger age when I stand on a hard floor in front of a class for a while, but I can still manage that. But I have had just a blast this summer going and talking to teachers, last spring talking to school groups. On Tuesday night, I spoke to a group at Smithton Elementary School south of Belleville, Illinois. And then earlier today, I had 100 teachers in the morning and 100 different teachers in the afternoon, and they're all excited about what's going on. They want to know. And they have, face a particular problem there in that they, many of them lie just outside the zone of totality. And what do they do? How do they manage this when it gets real close and there's the temptation to look? And I'm sorry, I can't advise them to look.
And speaking of experiences, we want everyone to safely enjoy this experience. And there is an opportunity, as I understand it, Don, for people who are so inclined. This will be the first day of classes at Eastern Illinois University. And there is an opportunity for the public to join with your students and faculty on campus. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, I think Dave has well described how a total eclipse is an awesome event. But the good thing about a partial eclipse is that it lasts longer. So, here in the Mattoon-Charleston area, we're going to reach a maximum of 95% coverage. But it'll be partial for well over 2 hours. So we're planning to have our activities from about noon until 2 p.m. at Eastern Illinois University. We're going to be mainly focused on in an area by the EIU Observatory, which, if you don't know where it is, you can come down Route 16, take a right on 4th Street, and it's down kind of around the campus pond. We're going to be sort of outdoors between the campus pond and the actual observatory, doing various activities outside. And there are various departments doing various things. I'm mainly aware of what the physics department is doing. And I think the art department is actually going to have an opportunity for people to be sketching things out there, art supplies, which is a great way to do things, right?
Yes.
Dave was talking about the sort of non-instrumental way of observing. And so, anyway, we will have a number of eclipse glasses to hand out, and I don't know what the number is. I don't know whether that number is greater than or smaller than the number of people who are going to show up, so I cannot completely guarantee that you will get a pair of eclipse glasses when you go out there, but we hope that you will. We will have the opportunity to make pinhole projection, so probably sort of paper plates, put a nice sized hole in them and project onto the ground or some other surface. We will have at least one, maybe hopefully more, telescopes set up with the proper filters and or projection. You can use the telescopes with projection where they project an image and you can see good detail that way. We should have the 16-inch telescope in the observatory, able to be used for viewing. Now that's going to be a one person at a time thing, right? So every person might get 5 seconds or something, to walk through and have a look at that. We're in the process of installing a solar telescope, but we cannot guarantee that will be up and running by then either, because there's a lot of work to do to get that going. But yes, there will be it should be a good time for everyone. I hope you all come out. I think they're saying there will be some food, some T-shirts, and lots of different activities. So yeah, we hope to see you there.
Good. Dave, Don, really appreciate you taking some time to visit with us this evening. We hope everybody enjoys and appreciates this experience of a lifetime that's coming up on August the 21st with the solar eclipse. And we hope you all will join us next week for the podcast from the Mattoon Public Library.